Welcome to the Orbit Books Podcast, featuring wide-ranging conversations with some of the best science fiction and fantasy writers in the genre. After the show, be sure to visit us at www.orbitbooks.net to join the conversation.
Welcome to Episode 1 of the Orbit Books Podcast. I'm your host, Jack Womack. Joining me today is Joe Abercrombie, author of the First Law Trilogy, Best Served Cold, and his new novel, The Heroes, anxiously awaited, critically acclaimed, and red-blooded in every possible way. Hello, Joe. Good to talk to you.
Hi, Jack. Good to be here, red-bloodedly or otherwise.
The Heroes. The first thing people say, having read it, tends to be, wow. And the next thing tends to often be, that's amazingly violent. And an amazingly good description of hand-to-hand battle, the old-school war, as it were. The three-day battle that makes up the narrative of the Heroes captures everything perfectly. The ego-driven start, the preparations that always go awry, then the long periods of waiting, recovering, and sudden explosions of violence, and then after, the sense of utter waste accomplished for little.
Yeah, I wanted to give as kind of as broad a picture of the whole thing as I could. I think in fantasy, you know, fantasy, epic fantasy certainly, often centers on war, has war as a background, full of swords, is full of fighting men, kings, battles, all these things. But it often lacks a lot of those things that, you know, I noticed seem to characterize warfare from my sort of reading of a lot of military history, which are, you know, boredom, incompetence, violence, discomfort. And I wanted to kind of try and bridge the gap between the two, if you like, and show, I suppose you might say, a sort of realistic depiction of warfare within a fantasy setting, if that makes any sense.
It does. Plus, you depict war so well. I mean, the reader feels directly in the middle of things, I mean, to the point where you're ducking to avoid those swords.
Yeah, I mean, I've no personal experience along those lines, but it's obviously nice to hear that it rings true. I've had a few emails from people who've kind of served in the forces, and a few of them seem to think that it rings true in one way or another. Often, as much about the sort of boredom, the tedium of warfare, as much as the you know, sudden explosions of violence.
Precisely. Well, I'd imagine you used both good research and good old imagination to put it together.
Absolutely, yeah. No, a combination of the two. And such small bits of experience I've had myself. I think in Full Metal Jacket, the film, one of the characters is asked, have you seen any action? And he replies, I've seen a little on TV. I suppose that would be my approach as well.
That covers it well, because it's just there are these wonderful moments of hilarity, always by way of the dialogue. I just the moment that immediately comes to mind is when the gigantic stranger come knocking shows up, more scar than skin, as you put it, and Dale just sort of tosses out, maybe it's time to think about a shield.
Yeah, I mean, I think humor's, you know, very important, especially within a book that's otherwise pretty dark, pretty grim, pretty nasty at times. You know, you want to give a sense of there being more to life than just nastiness. And I think, you know, in a way, humor increases the there's a good contrast between humor and darkness that only increases the effect of both, in a sense. So I try where possible. I don't know if you can try to be funny, but I certainly don't stop it being funny if it feels like, you know, it's suitable and needs to be. So I think it's important to have some light in the darkness, if you like, because it makes both feel more intense.
Well, I think in actual life, just for all of history, I think when soldiers are at war, one of the ways they alleviate the situation as best they can is just to use sarcasm and the darkest humor possible. I believe this has probably been going on since the time of the Greeks and the Romans.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I kind of wanted to give it, if you like, an every war quality. I didn't want to make it feel like it was of a certain period. I wanted it to feel like, I mean, I suppose many things about war haven't changed over time. As you say, the gallows humor and the approach, the discomfort, boredom and the fear and the pain. A lot of these things have been the same throughout history. So in a sense, I wanted it to feel, although it's not in any sense modern in terms of the technology and the culture, I wanted it to feel relevant to a modern reader, because can't pretend you're not writing for a modern audience, and you want them to relate to it as closely as possible.
It relates to the modern audience, I think, more directly than much fantasy does, purely because of those human elements and recognizable points of view and attitudes and humor. The absurdity, and just like the wonderful absurdity of it. But in War brings out a very dark sort of absurdity, much more, you know, than the usual bureaucratic nuttiness that we're always used to. How do you capture those darker ironies so well? I mean, do you just draw upon imagination, have just... It's a outlook that many of your characters have and have so fully. They inhabit those states.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose on one level it kind of developed as a reaction to a lot of the sort of fantasy that I read as a kid. That was my grounding. You know, I read a lot of sort of straight ahead commercial fantasy in the 80s when there was a great deal of that stuff that was, you know, coming along in the wake of Tolkien's success, I suppose. And a lot of that stuff, it takes itself quite seriously. You know, there's not necessarily much humour to it, and yet at the same time, while reading it, you can't avoid thinking there's sometimes something ridiculous about it. So I suppose it was born partly as a reaction to, you know, some of the fantasy that I'd read, and a feeling that characters in these situations wouldn't take things so seriously necessarily, and also just trying, I suppose, to make the characters feel real and trying to put myself in their position and seeing how you would react, just trying to give them as vivid a personality as possible and make the dialogue as kind of convincing and truthful as I could, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it just emerges naturally in the process of trying to do that, trying to write something that's honest and engaging.
Right. Tell me a little about each of your main characters. Let's see. Let's start with Bremer Dangorst.
Well, he is a master swordsman, I suppose, who's trained to be a swordsman from a very young age and achieved the position of being the king's bodyguard. But then following a unfortunate debacle, he lost his position. He thinks it wasn't really his fault. He thinks he was scapegoated. He lost his position and was kind of demoted. He's a sort of social outcast. He has no social skills, cursed with a silly high voice. And so he kind of, the only way he can gain back his position is by winning glory on the battlefield. And so he's come to this battle obsessed with redeeming himself through force of arms, in a sense, and he doesn't really care who gets on the other end of the sword. He doesn't really even care if it's him, if it means he can get his position back. So he's a kind of narcissistic, suicidal psychopath, really. Pretty typical for one of my characters, I'd say.
Well, he certainly lives by the three R's, retribution, revenge, and redemption, even if it requires killing everybody in sight. So...
Yeah, he doesn't really have a lot of... He doesn't have a lot of interest in other people, you might say. He lives in his own head. He can't really communicate very well with other people, so he's quite isolated and very, very angry internally, but unable to express that within social situations. So he's unable to express that to people on his own side. He can only take it out on strangers on the other side, really, who he has nothing against, really.
They're focused, in a sense.
Yeah.
Now, Calder, a marvelous coward in every possible way. Just really marvelous.
Very closely based on myself, of course, in that sense. He is similar to Gorse in the sense that he was he had a very high position. He was the son of a king, but then his father died, and Calder lost much of his sort of authority. So he, too, is obsessed with regaining his power. But he's, the antithesis of Gorse in the sense that he's... pretty much of a coward, physically, certainly. And he is much more effective as a talker and a charmer. And he really is a plotter and a schemer and is going to try and regain his position by treachery, fundamentally. As long as he doesn't have to fight for it.
It is good the way he sort of avoids that until he no longer can and then winds up accomplishing what no one expects from him. It's just really beautifully done.
Well, thank you. I mean, I try to make people surprising, I suppose. I try to make the event surprising, but obviously to be natural, to flow naturally from what the characters are. So, you know, I like to think that you're going to get something you don't necessarily expect read one of my books. I'd hope that you do, though, you know, you always have different reactions from every reader.
Now, Craw, who most reminds me of, I suppose, myself, since I'm always thinking I'm too old for this. And he just...
Veteran campaigner.
Exactly.
Now that you say that. Yeah, I mean, he's an older guy who is running out of energy. He's been a veteran. He's been fighting a long time. I suppose he's like a senior NCO, really, in modern parlance, who's... starting to lose his will to fight and just wants to kind of keep his close friends, his little unit, just wants to keep them alive and get through things so he can retire. But he's, you know, he's a guy who's got a lot of loyalty for the people around him, and he's referred to as a straight edge often by other people on his side because he still believes in an old, honourable way of doing things, although... that can have some pretty terrible consequences for him and the people around him because he believes in doing the right thing, and the right thing is always the right thing for everyone involved, if you see what I mean.
Exactly. Well, it's like as the old W.C. Fields saying went, funny old world, lucky if we get out of it alive.
Yeah, he always feels pretty lucky if they get through alive. But of course, not everyone always does.
Now, there's another major character in the book who is unlike most everyone else, being female. Fenry. Yeah. Talk about Fenry. Yeah.
Well, I suppose because it's about battle and war, it does become pretty heavily male-orientated. But I was keen that it shouldn't be totally dominated by men, so I wanted to kind of get women into the situation as much as I could, I suppose. And the sort of central female character is Fenry, who is the daughter of the commander of one side and is also married to a soldier. And she is... a very ambitious, clever, driven sort of woman who is kind of interested in trying to create her husband or paint her husband as a hero so that she can kind of move on in life, move up and become more powerful. She's very ambitious.
She's certainly very sharp and very savvy and very brave.
Yeah, indeed. She ends up getting somewhat involved in the action with unpleasant consequences for most involved. They often are.
Exactly. Now, some of the greatest absurdities in battle, as we know, take place when commanders are idiots, as we've certainly seen through history.
Sure.
And General Jollenhorm, just there he is, prancing around on his fine horse before he sends off the 6th Regiment, only to have it pretty much wiped out within a few minutes. It's hard not to think of, well, just, for example, the First World War, where you just run down the list of commanders on every side, and it's just... a very dark joke when you look at how things came out.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I suppose going back to the kind of the comparison between classic epic fantasy, there's all kinds of other fantasy out there these days, so you don't want to oversimplify, but I think there's a tendency in fantasy to kind of have a slightly simplistic view of warfare in which people have a wonderful plan and victory is the result of bravery and great planning being perfectly executed. And in fact, as you say, you know, victory, if you ever have such a thing in reality, is often a result of strange incompetence, weird mischances and wrinkles of personality that kind of then ripple out to have these profound and unexpected effects. I guess I was thinking of things like, you know, the Charge of the Light Brigade, where part of the reason why it happened was the interaction between the different officers in the chain of command who all hated each other. And as a result, they behaved in this outlandish way. You can hardly conceive of how that could have happened until you kind of understand the nature of the officers who were involved and the nature of their relationship with each other and kind of the whole social structure from which they emerged. So I was keen to kind of give some idea of how the different personalities, people can be effective in one situation, but in another, they can do something that's disastrous. You know, and bravery is of itself not necessarily a virtue unless it's combined with intelligence and the right situation. I sort of wanted to get across that people can be very brave in one situation, heroic in one situation, and another situation, cowardly or useless or deadly to their own friends. So, yeah, I wanted to sort of give some sense of that complexity in warfare.
You certainly do. Now, an American reader can't help but be reminded of the U.S. Civil War at times throughout the Heroes. I mean, the 3 days of battle, as was the case with Gettysburg, maneuvers reminiscent of Little Round Top, where it's the smallest and most unexpected actions turn the tide, the completely senseless fight over the bridge at Antietam. So, and which wars and battles did you read up on preparing for your books and research specific? I was just wondering if there are any specific ones that you had gone over.
Well, I've sort of, for many years, been reading quite widely on all kinds of different, not just military history generally, but certainly a lot of military history. And, I mean, the American Civil War is interesting you should mention, because that has always been something that I've been quite interested in. And I think there's something about how it sits kind of between the modern era and the pre-modern era, if you like. It sits on the verge of industrialization, and there's this kind of encroaching modern age, the technology of the modern age, combined with this sort of this great oratory and this great idealism, I suppose, that seems to come from somewhere earlier. Just a very fascinating period. And it also, I think those are some of the first battles that have that sense of development over time, that take place over several days and develop over time and have this sort of varied battlefield within which there can be different things going on in different areas. It just suited what I was trying to do. So I suppose, as you say, battles like Gettysburg and Shiloh and Antietam, these multi-day battles where you have a lot of interesting characters on the battlefield, a lot of interesting generals, a lot of relationships between people on the opposite sides as well as people on the same side. That was kind of an interesting model and certainly informative, but there's all kinds of different things, like I said, you know, the Charge of the Light Brigade. I think modern wars often more than the earlier stuff. So in a way, I think a lot of the models were from you know, 18th century onwards rather than the kind of medieval period where things were often, you know, very small scale.
Right.
Not necessarily suitable for such a sort of in-depth investigation of one battle.
Exactly. There's just, you know, as long as we're talking blood, I mean, you know, this American Civil War, I think, has been looked upon as the first modern war in the sense of trench warfare, of heavy civilian engagement. Though Antietam, with its 2,000-plus killed in a single day, certainly doesn't come close to the first morning of the Somme.
No. And, you know, that again was the kind of even greater scale, obviously. And I mean, I think, you know, things like the First World War poets and some of the First World War things, and also a lot of film and TV kind of things about war were quite informative or, you know, quite influential for me. So, you know, things like A Bridge Too Far, which obviously is a sort of study of a single, not necessarily one battle, but one kind of campaign, one operation, if you like. Which looks at a lot of different points of view and examines the whole event, and is also, you know, a lot of it is about incompetence, failure, and mischances. So things like that, and Waterloo and Gettysburg, these big films that are about one event, were quite influential. And also things like Generation Kill recently, which obviously is very, very modern, but is excellent on that whole thing of the kind of combination of the humdrum and the terrifying and the senselessness of a lot of it, and how people on the front line just, you know, often don't have any clue what's going on or why. And that's even with modern technology. So imagine how confusing it would have been for medieval, you know, people working with medieval technology.
It's really impossible to imagine somewhat, though you can get the general idea that there'd be a lot of confusion, a lot of arrows, and a lot of stabbing, and a lot of severed limbs all over the place.
I would have thought probably.
What battle scene? What was the first war film you saw where there was a battle scene that definitely made an impression on you?
Well, that's a tough one to answer, actually.
Just the earliest thing, just, you know, as the first one you happen to see and catch something in the theater or even on television, or just really thought, oh my goodness, this is worse than they talk about. So
it's hard to think. Right back to one. I mean, I think A Bridge Too Far was probably the first film that sticks in my mind as kind of, you know, there being a profound lack of heroism in it, or at least a profound lack of sort of glorification, if you will.
Right.
I think then obviously Saving Private Ryan is felt like a bit of a game changer at the time. The battle sequences and that were so immersive, so kind of personal. I think prior to that, there'd been often an attempt to show the great sweep of the event, big wide shots, hugeness. And with Saving Private Ryan, you get much more of a kind of intimate feel of what it's like to be there yourself. And so that obviously was quite interesting. And that, again, had a big effect, I think, on Band of Brothers. And I found Band of Brothers very effective as well in a similar kind of way. So often it's, you know, Second World War things, I think, often is... does tend to be filmed an awful lot. So,
but now, what do you think is the greater attraction, which I think we've seen in our lifetimes, on the depiction of extreme violence in every form of media, be it TV, games, music, death metal, for example, hugely popular in the most unlikely places, just in the Middle East, in Norway and Sweden? Is this just cyclical catharsis, do you think?
Hard to say. It's hard to say what the motivation is. I suppose, you know, in a way, when you look at you know, things like westerns of the 50s, they're very violent. Since the body counts can be huge, but they're often not very gritty, if you like. They don't create much of a sense of the sort of pain and unpleasantness. I certainly think there's been tendency to be more interested in the detail, if you like. And whether that's a healthy thing or not, I'm not sure. I suppose it depends a lot on the kind of angle you take. You know, I know there's obviously a big tendency towards very gory horror films lately, which is something that I'm, you know, has passed me by a bit. Can't say I find it particularly interesting, but it all depends what you're aiming to do with it. And I think if it's used to kind of create an impactful sense of what it's like being involved with violence, which is deeply unpleasant, even from my very limited experience.
Exactly.
That's fair game. You know, that's good. That you should be trying to, you know, make it visceral, make it real for people who are reading, people who are watching. But if you're kind of totally reveling in it, I'm not sure it achieves much in a way.
Exactly. Well, people in the U.S. and the U.K., I mean, for many, many decades, centuries, the average person was generally exposed to more potential day-to-day violence. I mean, from the Elizabethan era, where... Yes. Marlowe is being stabbed in a bar, and then not to mention the Roaring Boys during the Regency, just carrying on like they were straight out of Clockwork Orange. And we certainly have our long tradition of gangs and gang fights here in New York.
Well, clearly there's a fascination for it, and there's a fascination for everyone. I suppose that's one thing that I'm trying to sort of investigate in the Heroes is, you know, why people have this obsession with violence and this obsession with violent men, in a sense, and glorifying violent men. So perhaps, you know, as the world gets less violent, we become more and more interested in stories of violence. It speaks to something, I think, quite deep, especially in men, glorifying in warfare.
And I said, well, what's interesting as well is that the same distancing is even taking place now in Western militaries. I mean, where you have drones dropping bombs and where the person involved isn't even close to the battlefield.
Yeah, and I think also modern training has changed things a lot because obviously, you know, soldiers are very highly trained these days and they're trained to react very effectively. In some ways, overcome natural reluctance people have to killing other people. Very few people, supposedly, this is what I understand, very few people are actually capable of killing other people normally because we're kind of psychologically designed and conditioned against it. Whereas, you know, a lot of military training is designed to overcome that natural survival instinct, if you like, or the instinct to not kill other people in the same species. So I think, you know, the experience of the soldier, the effectiveness of the soldier is vastly higher than it would have been in medieval armies, where a lot of them would have been pretty ineffective, I would imagine, would have fallen apart very quickly. And obviously, you know, you pay the psychological price later.
That was certainly the case in the American Civil War, where a lot of people went off, joined, and then in the very first battle realized exactly what they were up against and took off to the rear at the first possible chance.
And the understanding of what warfare was like was obviously hugely limited. Are you aware of the Dead of Antietam, the kind of photographic display there was? The first time dead bodies had ever really been photographed, because it was also the first war that was widely photographed, well, the American Civil War. And so it was the first time the public had been exposed to what a battlefield looks like. And prior to that, there were only very idealized paintings and descriptions. And so, in a way, it's impossible to imagine what it was like then to not be exposed to a lot of very intimate images of warfare that we see on the screen all the time these days. We've got a pretty good idea of what these things look like. Right then they didn't, and they were sensational when people saw
them. Oh, exactly. Well, the first major battle of the U.S. Civil War, when the Battle of Bull Run, people came to the battlefield to stand off and watch the action as if it was some sort of game until they realized...
They were tangled up, yeah, with
right,
the
kind
of ladies in their carriages on as they fled to... Escape, the great skedaddle, wasn't it?
Just an absolute mess. And people, I think, at that point started to realize, oh, this is a little different than what we expected. So,
yeah.
Well, Joe, one last question here. I know you're a family man. At what age do you believe you'll let your children get anywhere near your books?
Well, they climb over piles of them now.
Well, yes.
But they're not really old enough to read even relatively basic books quite yet, which is lucky for me because I haven't had the difficulty. I have to take a little judgment on how advanced I think they are. But I guess no younger than 14, I wouldn't have thought they're quite adult, aren't they? I don't know if they'll see me differently as a result. Probably not.
Oh, no, I wouldn't think so. I actually keep all my editions in my daughter's room just because, and she's 8 now almost, and she's able to say, those are the books that Daddy wrote, which is always good. But has she shown any interest in reading them? No, luckily she's on her iTouch.
Well, exactly. That's it. More exciting things to do.
Exactly. Joe, it's been a really great conversation.
Absolutely, Jack, as always.
We'd like to thank our listening audience and again invite you to visit us at www.orbitbooks.net and join the conversation.